It's time to get real gone on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. Here's your host, James Riley.
It's the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour, and in the studio is drummer extraordinaire Mr. Ronnie Tutt. Now, if you've seen footage of Elvis in the documentaries, That's the Way It Is, and Elvis on Tour, or even in the live special Aloha from Hawaii, you know just how explosive of a drummer this guy is. We're going to talk to him about his days with Elvis, as well as playing with other artists like Billy Joel, Neil Diamond, Jerry Garcia, Roy Orbison, Elvis Costello, and many others. And we're also going to hear music from these artists that feature his powerhouse drums. Now we're going to kick it off with a track from Elvis's Moody Blue album that was released in July of 1977, just 1 month before his death. This is Way Down on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour.
Hey, you get closer. Going dim, the sound of the breather has made the mood I'm in. All of my resistance lying on the floor, taking me to places I've never been before. Ooh, and I can feel.
Down. That's Elvis Presley and J.D. Sumner hitting that low note. Hey, it features our guest today on drums, Mr. Ronnie Tutt. Now, we talked to Ronnie about switching from the trumpet to the drums in high school.
Well, I was, as a child, I was pretty much considered a child prodigy tap dancer. So I always wanted to express myself rhythmically. So I was hearing rhythm patterns and all of that. Trumpet was kind of boring to me, but it's one of those things that a friend had it in his closet. It was his dad's trumpet, and I was wanting to get away from the violin, and that thing, shiny trumpet, looked pretty nice. So I just grabbed hold of that and took it pretty far, but really was frustrated because I wanted to be a drummer.
Sure.
I thought. Anyway.
Was there somebody that influenced you on the drums?
Oh, just all the great music that was going around, but I loved to watch the drum battles, with Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa and Louie Velts, and those guys are just, particularly Gene Krupa, was fascinating.
Where's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, can't go, but don't you double my blues ways. You can do anything, help my blues ways. You can knock me down or stab in my face, flatten my hands all over the place. Do anything that you want to do, but honey, lay off of my shoes, and don't you dabble my blue suede shoes. You can do anything, but they all for my blues. Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get a red, and I'm cool, can't go, don't you? Never my blues ways. You can do anything, but they all for my blues ways. Hey! It's one for the money, two for the show, three to get it ready. Now go, can't go, but don't you devil my blue trades. You can do anything, but I hope my blue trades. Blue, blue, and a blue trade shoes, got a blue, blue, and a blue trade shoes, baby. Blue, blue, and a blue trade shoes, got a blue, blue, and a blue trade shoes. You can do anything, but they hope for my blue trades.
Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. Our guest today, Ronnie Tutt. Now, if you ever seen some video footage of Elvis, you see Ronnie back there on the drums. He might remind you of Animal from the Muppets. Here's Ronnie.
Well, that's another story. Some people think that Jim Henson got that idea from watching.
Well, he probably did.
I've never had it confirmed or denied.
Yeah. So. Do you think that's what got you the job with Elvis?
I think what got me the job with him was the eye contact, the visual.
Yeah.
Being able to read what he was doing.
Sure.
DJ Fontana and I have always talked about how working with Elvis is like working with a pseudo stripper.
Yeah.
You know, because every move he made with his body,
yeah,
he always wanted you to be, instead of just playing regular drum things, he wanted a little hits and pushes and things like that.
And you were probably on the whole time trying to pay attention.
Absolutely,
to
his yeah.
Train I ride 16 coaches long. I'm the king of the jungle, they call me the tiger. bearcat comes a running and the hound dog they get waving, waving, waving.
Do you remember what you were feeling the first time you played live with Elvis?
Total fear.
Yeah.
Total panic.
Yeah.
And he was like a panther pacing back and forth, you know, in his black outfit. And he had nothing to worry about, but he was a very insecure guy when it came to those kind of things. He was so concerned about what people would think.
Yeah.
I mean, he had taken his beating, so to speak, in life.
Sure.
At a very early age, you know. Extremely controversial figure, judging because on the fact of all the different celebrities and artists and people that came to see it on a nightly basis here in Vegas. I mean, every major movie star, every major artist was there. Pretty tense for him.
And I'm sure the word of mouth among that too. But, probably made him more nervous as it went on.
Yeah, plus he was trying to set some records himself.
Yeah.
Some challenges from Tom Jones, and you know, he was serious, but yet friendly competition.
Yeah.
It was, of course, Sinatra, the years of all the records he had set, so he was out to prove a point.
It is interesting that most of the footage I've seen of Elvis before going on stage, he always seemed to be pacing back and forth, just nervous.
Very, very nervous.
Yeah, I wonder if that helped him, I mean, just to stay on edge.
Yeah, of course it did.
I also read that you had met Elvis in the 50s. Yeah. But didn't particularly care for him as much.
Yeah, that was a strange situation. We were the Saturday night, once a week, radio band from the Northside Jamboree, we called it, which was the equivalent to Louisiana Hayride and Grand Ole Opry here. He came in with Bill Black and Scotty Moore and just the three of them. He was the rhythm. And of course, Bill Black did a slapping bass and he, in no time, had broken all most of the strings on his guitar and reached down and grabbed our lead guitar player, not lead guitar, rhythm guitar player, Brad, was a beautiful old brown top, black top, flat top box, old Martin, I believe it was, blonde front, and just trashed it and never even said a word. You know, picked marks all over it and everything. He never really had much respect for instruments.
Yeah.
He was original rock and roller in that sense.
Did you tell him the story years later?
No, we never got into it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Young man on drums, he's from Dallas, Big D. His name is Ronnie Tutt. The guy that plays a whole lot of Fender bass, his name is Jerry Schiff. Jerry. So that's Tutt and that's Schiff. That's Tutt Schiff, any way you look at it, boy, I'll tell you for sure.
It's the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. We're talking with drummer Ronnie Tutt. Now, Ronnie tells us about it was Elvis's idea to have this full stage rock band, orchestra, and two vocal groups.
Well, it definitely was. He told me the story of one night he woke up from a dream and he had visualized that whole thing. And he called Colonel Parker on the phone and woke him up and said, "Hey, Colonel, this is what I've seen." And Colonel said, "Well, I'm sorry, we've already got you in with the whole stage setting. It's going to kind of be like Jailhouse Rock with a line of dancers in the back with, you know, no band scene and anything and all that. It's going to be like a big production." He says, "I'm already working on that." And he says, "Well," he told me, "you know, it's the only time I ever hung up on the Colonel." And he said, "I'm either going to do it the way I saw it, or I'm not going to do it."
Yeah.
Well, evidently he won.
Yeah, so. He did.
Yeah. And you're right, he did set a precedent.
Yeah.
As far as I know, I don't think anybody was doing that
no.
at that point. Well, not particularly not at the scale in which he pulled it off.
Sure.
I mean, it's this huge orchestra behind it. And all the vocals, you know, it was like a choir, so to speak.
We got to patch it up, baby, before we fall apart at the seams. We got to patch it up, baby, we can't let time unravel our dream. Let's go back and touch the past. One more night is all I ask. Get that feeling, that old feeling. We can patch it up, baby. We can patch it up, baby. We can patch it up, baby. Patch it up with a whole lot of love. We got to patch it up, baby. Let's sweep out all the cobwebs of our heart. We got to patch it up, baby, before indifference pulls us apart. Let's don't let a good love die. Let's give it just one more try. With that feeling, that old feeling. Feeling, healing. We can patch it up, baby. We can patch it up. We can patch it up, baby. We can patch it up, baby.
it up, baby. We can patch it up, baby. Patch it up with a whole lot. Hold on.
Let's talk about it. We're recording this on March 28th. You guys recorded Burn in Love this day in 1972.
Really?
Tell me about that song. Did he hear, or do you may not know, did he hear the original that Dennis Lynn wrote, or there was Arthur Alexander did a cover it too?
Yeah, I honestly don't remember
the
whole situation other than the fact that my recollection of it was that it was played for us. Whether it be a demo or whatever it was, we were trying to encourage him to do more rock and roll.
Yeah.
And we heard it and we thought, man, this is going to be great. You know? Unfortunately, his producer, Felton Jarvis, was very, very ill that particular night. He was a little later on, passed away from liver complications. And he was so sick, he had to lay down in the control room. So I basically took the session over. Produced the record for a farm of the pelt with Henry Gordy playing bass camp with his great bass lines and made a good rock and roll record.
Oh, sure. I can still remember in college, CDs were still pretty new at this point, and hearing Burn in Love, a buddy of mine, John McGuire, who I'm sure will be listening, we're sitting in our dorm room in Georgetown, Kentucky. Hearing Burn in Love for the first time on CD and just jaws dropping of like, wow, listen to how great that sounds. I didn't even know there was cowbell on the original. This is amazing. Mm. But now, of course, things are going back to vinyl. You know, it's kind of
sure.
The hipster
thing. Well, full circle.
It is, isn't it?
You know, you wait around long enough. That record still sounds good today.
It sure does.
You know, somebody played it for me not too long ago. I was very surprised it sounded so good.
Yeah.
we touched on Always on My Mind. That was a difficult time for Elvis, and the rapport between the two of you guys in the studio was pretty cool to watch. What was that experience like?
I did know that it was a period where he was going through a lot of changes. You know, his life was pretty in upheaval. And we're all trying to encourage him, you know, keep going. You know,
sure.
It's been easy to kind of fold.
It's a pretty emotional performance.
Yeah.
Maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. You were always on my mind. Maybe I didn't hold you all those lonely, lonely times. And I guess I never told you I'm so happy that you're mine. If I made you feel second best, girl, I'm so sorry I was blind. I just never took the time. You were always on my mind. As I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Maybe I didn't hold you all those lonely, lonely times. And I guess I never told you I'm so happy that you're mine.
It's the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. We're talking with drummer Ronnie Tutt. Now, we talked with him about the ever-present video cameras during filming of That's the Way It Is and Elvis on Tour, and also what Elvis was like in the studio.
Well, you're always a little inhibited, but he had a great attitude towards... he had done enough movies, not necessarily live stuff, but we would just start to do these documentary-type movies. That's the Way It Is... in concert and so forth, Aloha from Hawaii special. He would say, guys, don't get hung up and don't let these cameras bother you. We're here to do a show. We're going to do a show first, and if they capture it, great. You know, and that was his philosophy, and it worked for him. It helped ease us because we're studio players, and you know, as well. And we always wanted it to be metronomically perfect, like you would in the studio. But he's, dang that, you know, he wanted it to be exciting and if he wanted to move up with things and make things more exciting. So if they rushed or dragged or whatever, they weren't perfect. Little ebbs and flows, as you know, that's what we call them. So.
What was he like in the studio compared to on stage?
Well, he hated the idea of being in a room, a sound room. It was not very appealing to him because I think he was a purist. I think he really appreciated being able to have something capture what he was doing live, and as opposed to adapting to what the studio would have you do, which was basically be behind a bunch of flats and drops and you know, wearing headphones and not feeling the music. He loved to feel the music. He always would stand in front of me most of the time. I mean, he had to make his rounds on the stage, but he enjoyed it most when he'd just stand right in front of me. That way he could feel the drums. Not only hear them, but feel them. He would do that in the studio sometimes. He'd just take his microphone off the stand and just like say, hang with it, you know, and come over and stand in front of me. And producer's pulling his hair out, but that's the way it was.
He always struck me being able to cut up and have a good time, but then also being serious and down to business.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, he definitely was both of those.
Yeah.
One extreme to the other.
Sure.
Down in Louisiana, where the alligators grow so mean, there lives a girl that I swear to the world made the alligators look tame. Oh, Silent Annie, oh, he's got you good. Yeah. Everybody said it was a shame, because the mama was a working on the chain gang. Every day before supper time, go down by the truck patch, pick her up as a folk salad along, carry it home with a toast. Everybody said it was a shame, cause her mama was a working on the chain gang. Think of what I do. Daddy was lazy in low county, claimed he had a bad back. All her brothers were fit for it. Said the watermelon's out of my truck, crash home, telling Annie. Oh,
here you go.
Yeah. Everybody said it was a shame, y'all, because the mama was working on the chain gang. Soccer little, Charlie Dillon.
Comparing Elvis and Neil Diamond on stage just seems fairly different in their approach. What's Neil like?
Well, I think the main difference in the two of those guys is, and I've learned this over a period of time, is that Neil is pretty much a perfectionist in the sense that he his philosophy is to do things in repetition over and over so that you feel completely comfortable under all circumstances of pulling it off. And that's helped, it helped me learn that, because with Elvis, it was either really up or sometimes really down. Mm-hmm. And part of that, of course, was his problem with prescription drugs.
Yeah.
We didn't really understand it at the time, but it makes a lot of sense in retrospect. But on the other hand, Elvis's up performances were about as great as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Just like Neil's are when they're really, really up.
Sure.
There's not that much variance in Neil's performance, mm-hmm. though. Almost like you've got a well-coached team you're going out there to win, and you know you've got the capability of winning every time you go out. It's pretty comforting to know that, I suppose, to kind of be subject to whatever the feeling is from the audience, the reaction.
Sure.
Because Elvis would like to dictate how good a show he would really push himself to do, even though he was very devoted to fans, basically, or he wouldn't have been there in the first place. But that was the main difference in those two guys.
Yeah. Well, I want to play a live version he recorded with Neil of I'm a Believer. You know, some people think it's just a Monkees song, but Neil wrote it and recorded it before the, of course, it was in Shrek. Yeah. Kind of a resurgence of it.
Right, it didn't hurt.
Yeah, no.
I thought love was only true in fairy tales. For somebody else, but not for me. Love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all of my dreams. Then I saw her face. Yeah, I'm a believer. Not a trace. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. No, not if I tried. Not if I tried, no. Thought love was more or less a given thing. Seems the more I gave, the less I got. All you did is pain. When I needed some sunshine, I got rain. Then I saw her face. I'm a believer. Not a trace. Put that in my mind, yeah. I'm in love. I'm a believer. Yeah, I'm a believer. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It's the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour with Ronnie Tutt here in the studio. You were on a project with Roy Orbison there towards the end of his life. And it was during a resurgence of him with the Trapping Wilburys and the Mystery Girl record coming out. and just a fantastic performance, live CD and DVD. People in the band, Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, Tom Waits, Elvis Costello, Jackson Browne, Katie Lang. I mean, it's just an unbelievable performance. What was that experience like?
Well, it was really exciting. We took about a week of out of our schedule to do this, and consisted of going through a huge stack of his songs. And T-Bone Burnett had put us all together. I've been doing quite a bit, our band basically, and as well as me, I've been doing quite a bit of work with T-Bone at that time. So we all felt comfortable together, and even though I had never worked with Roy before, or never even met him until that particular point in time, I had, of course, a lot of respect and liking for his songs that he had written. But once we started going through these, I had a stack on the music stand on the flat over here next to the drums, and it was about 2 inches thick. And we go through one song, and then they go, "Oh, that's good, let's go on the next one." You know, we're turning these songs over and go, "Did he write that? Wow, he wrote that too." And wow, you know, I was flabbergasted that he had written so much, one after the other, these wonderful, wonderful songs. And of course, that was the reason why he was able to attract so many of these great artists that were willing to come along and support him and be part of it. It's because a lot of those people were writers. And me not being a writer, I wasn't so as familiar as they were.
Yeah.
So, but it was a great challenge to put that many people together, but it was very rewarding.
Sure.
You know, it was rewarding to come back and kind of ease back of it. We weren't trying to do a heavy rock and roll version of all of these. We were trying to do kind of what we do, but at the same time have respect for what was done before. So I think it got captured pretty well. The first release of it on CD was not really that great as far as the mix is concerned, but they came back in at a later date and remixed it all, and whoever did it then, I can't recall, got it right.
Oh, great.
It really sounds much, much better.
Yeah.
It sounds like the way it did when we were doing it.
Sure.
Or I hoped it would.
Yeah. I was talking with Dion before, who had toured Australia with Roy Orbison, and he was talking about how he was surprised at how quiet he seemed when he sang, but yet it projected so well. Mm-hmm. I heard other people talk about that too. It's like, is he even singing? And then they go here in a control room, and they're like, wow, this big voice came, because he didn't really open his mouth. Really.
No, no, he was a Texas guy, and part of the Texas culture is not to be too big mouths.
You know? Okay.
He kind of smiled with your teeth together.
Yeah.
Well, I got a brand new baby and I feel so good. She loves me even better than I thought she would. I'm on my way to her house and I'm blown out of breath. When I see her tonight, I'm gonna squeeze it to death. Claudette, pretty little pet, Claudette, never make me fret, Claudette. She's the greatest little girl that I've ever met. I get the best loving that I'll ever get from Claudette. Whoa. Get the best love and that I'll ever get from Claudette. Whoa, whoa, Claudette. Yeah, yeah, Claudette. that you married me. I'm gonna be so happy for the rest of my life. And my brand new baby is my brand new wife. Claudette, pretty little fit, Claudette, never make me fret, Claudette. She's the greatest little girl that I've ever met. I get the best loving that I'll ever get from Claudette.
So we mentioned Elvis Costello. You and James Burton, Jerry Schaaf, were also on a project of his, King of America.
Yeah.
That was pretty neat. I guess to work with another Elvis.
Yeah, I mean, he's quite a character. You know, of course, he was on the black and white thing. He stood right next to me. Right to my left there. We had a lot of fun locking it in together.
Yeah. Want to play a song from that called The Big Light.
Well, I had a little feeling to have a big night, and I woke up feeling smart and not so brave and not quite right. At the face of who am I? Where is she? What did I do? First of all, I had to face the big light. Cause the big light came to my window and it opened up my eyes, and it snapped them up like roller blinds. The only things that I had can't face. And I'm thankful that I didn't open another bottle of inspiration. Well, the hangover this morning had a personality, and I cast my shattered mind over selected memories. I didn't even touch the light switch, so I knew I'd never see the haggard face that would be staring back at me. The big light came to my window and it opened up my eyes. It snapped them up like roller blinds. Told me things that I did. Can't face another day or night. Good ideas, complication, and I'm thankful that I didn't open another bottle of
track you told me about that you played on, which is just fantastic, and my favorite, I'm sorry, this is Cat Stevens' Peace Train.
Oh yeah, that was quite an experience.
Yeah, did you spend much time with him?
Not much time other than the studio, but he had there's certain artists that have a clear picture of what they're looking for, and because of they have written the songs as well as just going to go in and sing something that a producer has put in front of them.
You know, yeah,
another writer has written. But with his situation, he knew exactly how he wanted the end thing and the feeling and the sound. And it was like watching a master chef like build the whole thing.
Yeah.
And he did, and wow, what a wonderful track it turned out.
Come take me home again. I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. Yes, peace train, holy roller.
Everyone jump up on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh. Come on.
You played on Piano Man.
Right. Yeah, did two albums with Billy. The first album was Piano Man.
Yeah.
The second one was called Street Life Serenade.
Yeah.
Both of those albums had some really good tracks.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, just the term Piano Man is synonymous with Billy Joel.
It is.
He seemed to be a great lover of doo-wop and some other early rock and roll, too.
For sure. Yeah, it really was reflected in his early writings. And in fact, I've always said about Billy is if he ever decides on who he is, he's going to be great.
Yeah. You
know? And he did. And he
yes,
is.
Absolutely.
You know.
It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday. A regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin. He says, son, can you play me a memory? I'm not really sure how it goes, but it's sad and it's sweet and I knew it complete when I wore a younger man's clothes. La 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 la. Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight. Well, we're all in the mood for a melody, and you've got us feeling all right. Now, John at the bar is a friend of mine. Gets me my drinks for free, and he's quick with a joke or to light up your smoke, but there's some place that he'd rather be. He says, Bill, I believe this is killing me, as a smile ran away from his face. Well, I'm sure that I could be a movie star if I could get out of this place. Now Paul is a real estate novelist who never had time for a wife, and he's talking with David, who's still in the Navy and probably will be for life. Coming to see, to forget about life for a while. And the piano, it sounds like a carnival, and the microphone smells like a beer, and they sit at the bar and put bread in my jar and say, man, what are you doing here? Oh, la 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 di di da, la la. Sing us a song, you're the piano man.
talk to me about a Jerry Garcia band. Mm. That had to be something pretty cool.
Yeah. It was quite a contrast in gigs because I was working with Elvis at the time. We were going from two-piece rhinestone suits to tie-dye jeans, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite an experience. I had done Jerry's first... he did one studio album before he decided to do the second one. And I was contacted by his bass player / producer, John Kahn. Mm-hmm. And then he was come in and play in the studio with Jerry. And it went along so well, we hit it off so well that they asked me if I'd be interested in coming up in the Bay Area. I was living on the West Coast at the time in the LA area. And they asked me if I would consider coming up to Northern California to do some gigs in the Bay Area. And I said, well, sure, yeah. Because at that particular time, our band had just finished a couple of projects with Emmy Lou, and they were going out as the hot band. And I had kind of, I don't know how to put this delicately, but I was looking for new musical horizons. I put it that way. As far as the guys, you know. And I knew they would all be great players with Emmy and all of that, but when this opportunity came, it was kind of freeing up musically.
Yeah.
And so I decided to start doing some gigs with them. And they asked me to be part of the band and so forth. So, yeah, we ended up doing a few projects.
Yeah.
Few albums and things. It was a great experience. Working with Garcia was wonderful. He's one of the most dramatic guitar players in the sense of being able to move people in an interesting way. He almost would make the guitar cry. You know, he just had that ability to really move people, particularly in the ballads, the way he would just sing. He was just like, just sail. His music, his melodies, his licks, and his solos would just sail. And he also appreciated good feeling tracks, good feeling music. So, and we laughed a lot because John Kahn is one of the most naturally funny men you ever meet. Just his looks, expressions he would give. And,
yeah.
And our roadie, Steve Parrish, was very funny too. So we had a lot of good times.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. And that's part of making music. If you can laugh and have a good time, you know, as well as
sure.
good music, then you're doing something special.
He also gave you guys a chance to do some extended jams. I mean, the songs were pretty long. Well,
that's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
Well, I had to look at that gig as my role was basically to hold everything together. I don't even think I ever played a solo. And I've never really considered myself a great solo player anyway, even though Elvis had us do it quite a bit
sure.
in the last few years. But that's a whole other story why. But with Jerry, I really felt like, with those guys, I really felt my role was just to keep time, make it comfortable for them, and to hold it together. Because it would get spaced out.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of reasons for that.
And you also did the bass vocal part on Johnny Rivers' cover of Jimmy Smith's Rockin' Pneumonia.
Yeah, Johnny was a friend of ours because we just got along really well, as well as he would hire Jerry and I and sometimes James or Ry Cooter or Jerry McGee or whoever could play, you know, if James was busy or something. We'd go out on the weekends and do gigs, pretty upscale clubs. Or college gigs, those kind of things. So I love Johnny's music. You know, he always wanted for it to feel right. You know, being a Louisiana guy, he understood. So we always got along really well playing music together. So We did a few albums together. That one, say the bass part. Jim Gordon played drums on it, but I happened to be in the studio, in another studio where he was cutting that track at the time, playing on somebody else's album. And he said, "Hey, Ronnie, come in here. Let's see if you can do this bass part."
Yeah.
Yeah, but Johnny later on did a couple of real interesting spiritual Christian gospel albums that I played.
Still have the stage outfits you
wore? Yeah, I do.
Yeah. When was the last time you tried one on?
I'm not at liberty to say.
While nobody's looking.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. It was a little tremor back then.
Yeah, we all were.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what age will do for you.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and good food.
Yeah. You played on Delaney and Bonnie. From Delaney's.
Yeah, actually, Jerry Sheff and I both joined that group at the same time, probably in 1970. Elvis wasn't doing much at that particular time, so we had almost like a year of ability to go out and form, be with the group and tour and do some amazing concerts.
Yeah, want to hear a song, Soul Shake, from that project. That's a good one. Well, Ronnie, I appreciate the time, and thank you for helping keep great music alive.
Well, man, it's a pleasure to try to help, and appreciate your efforts, and it's been great to be a part of it.
Soul Shake.
You've been listening to the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. And special thanks to our guest this episode, the one and only Ronnie Tutt. Wow, that was great to hear these stories. Hey, you can find us on the internet, rockabillyandblues.com. That's rockabilly, the letter N, blues.com. And from there, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and send us emails and all that fun stuff. Hey, until next time, this is James Riley. Keep on rockin'.